I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. When we left off, Lee Harvey Oswald had just been discharged from the Marine Corps, serving his last day on September 11th, 1959. He was discharged from the Marines so that he could go back to Fort Worth and help his supposedly ailing mother. In this episode, we begin our examination of Oswald's time in Russia. How did he get to Russia? Why did he choose Helsinki, Finland as the location from which to enter Russia? And what happened once Oswald made it to Moscow?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. In the last episode, we determined that Oswald never intended to care for his mother, and that his mom was likely aware of that fact. Marguerite told her first doctor, Dr. Goldberg, that her son was planning to defect to Russia, according to an FBI report. She mentioned to her landlord that her son would only be in town for a few days when Oswald arrived at Marguerite's apartment after he had been discharged from the Marines. So keep in mind that as Oswald makes his way from Santa Ana to Fort Worth and eventually to Russia, he's on a mission that was important enough for him to start it 3 months earlier than he would have without the early discharge. Now, I'm still unclear on why Oswald couldn't have just waited until December to go to Russia, but for whatever reason, he decided that his trip to the Soviet Union could not wait, so much so that he involved his mother in creating a fraudulent reason to leave the Marine Corps early. On September 16, 1959, Oswald left Fort Worth on his way to New Orleans. When he arrived the next day, Oswald went to see Lewis Hopkins Travel Consultants at the International Trade Mart. Hopkins also regularly handled travel arrangements for Clay Shaw, who would go on to be prosecuted by Jim Garrison for alleged involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, it could just be a coincidence that Oswald's travel plans were made by the same person who was assisting Clay Shaw. After all, Hopkins was working in the same building as Shaw. But I thought it was strange enough to mention. Lewis Hopkins said that Oswald asked for the cheapest and earliest ship to Europe. He paid $220 cash for a one-way ticket to Le Havre, France. On September 20th, Oswald boarded the Marion Lycus freighter, making his way across the ocean. The night before he left, Oswald wrote a letter to his mother where he said, quote, "Just remember, above all else, that my values are different from Robert's or yours. It is difficult to tell you how I feel. Just remember, this is what I must do. I did not tell you about my plans because you could hardly be expected to understand." Now, if Marguerite Oswald really told Dr. Goldberg that her son would be defecting to Russia 9 months before he did, as the FBI report says, then she shouldn't have been surprised about him going to Russia. She would have known that this was something that he was planning to do all along. Similarly, she told her landlord, Grace Craner, that Lee wouldn't be home very long. So Marguerite knew that Lee was leaving. That's why this letter is a little confusing, and it seems like it could be written for some other audience than Lee's mom. But maybe she was still against him going to Russia, even though she knew that he was going. Maybe she didn't want him to go. In that case, the letter is much more likely to be genuine. After 18 days at sea, Oswald's ship docked at Le Havre, France on October 8th. The next day, his passport says that he arrived in Southampton, England. He then made the 80-mile trek to London so that he could catch a flight to Helsinki, Finland. Now, the only flight from London to Helsinki that would be consistent with the date stamps on Oswald's passport was Finnair Flight 852, which arrived in Helsinki at 11:33 p.m. on October 10th. There's a memo from Richard Helms, the CIA's deputy director of plans, to the Warren Commission that says that Oswald couldn't have cleared customs and traveled from the airport to the hotel for him to make it to the hotel by midnight, which is when the hotel says that Oswald arrived. That memo, Commission Exhibit 2677, speculates that Oswald may have taken another route to get to Finland. That's not the only question mark around Oswald's arrival in Helsinki. His name was not found on any of the arrival lists for flights that were coming into Finland. In December of 2023, the Finnish intelligence agency, known as Supo, released declassified documents that said Oswald most likely arrived from Helsinki via Stockholm, Sweden. But there were no Swedish stamps on Oswald's passport. So we don't know for sure how Oswald got to Finland. The fact that there's no record of him entering the country, aside from his passport stamp, doesn't make any sense. But it's also possible that Oswald didn't arrive at the hotel at midnight exactly, and someone just wrote midnight to make sure that he paid for the night's stay. If so, then the flight arriving from London at 11:33 p.m. would seem to make a lot of sense. Regardless of how Oswald made it to Helsinki, things start to get more interesting once he's there. Upon arriving, he checked into Hotel Turney, a 5-star hotel where presidents, royalty, and celebrities stayed when they visited. The hotel also served as an espionage headquarters for the British and Soviets at the end of World War II. After staying at Hotel Turney for two nights, Oswald checked in to the Klaus Kirke Hotel for another three nights. Klaus Kirke was another very expensive place to stay, though not quite as fancy as Hotel Turney. The two hotels were only three blocks apart. Oswald's hotel accommodations in Helsinki raise a few questions. First and foremost, why was he staying in such fancy hotels, and where did he get the money for it? The Warren Commission claimed that Oswald had $1,500 in savings, but the only money that we know for sure that Oswald had was $200 from a savings account that he had just withdrawn all of the funds from. When Oswald arrived in the UK, he told a British immigration official that he had $700 cash in his possession. So we don't actually know how much money Oswald had. My initial thought was that he probably had a lot of money in savings from his time in the military. But servicemen in Japan in the late 1950s were paid in military script, which could only be used at the base. It couldn't be converted into cash. This means that the only actual cash savings that Oswald had from the Marines would have been if he saved all of the $1,107.20 that he earned while stationed in Santa Ana, which was convertible to cash. And if he did that, it would make sense for him to have around $700 in cash left after he paid to travel from New Orleans to France and France to England. Given that he still had to pay for the travel arrangements to make it from Helsinki to Moscow, why would Oswald burn through his limited funds staying at the most expensive hotel in Helsinki? Maybe even a more important question is, why did Oswald travel to Helsinki in the first place? There were numerous other places where he could have applied for a Soviet visa and traveled to Russia. We know that Oswald had Finland in mind from the time that he submitted his passport application, because the application mentions possibly attending the University of Turku in addition to Albert Schweitzer College. Oswald applied for a visa to the Soviet consulate in Helsinki on October 13th. His visa was issued one day later, on October 14th. Within one day? That seems like a very fast timeline to get a visa. But was it? According to former KGB agent Yuri Nosenko, the timing of Oswald's visa was standard. There was no reason for the USSR to not grant the visa, since Oswald was only 19 years old and he didn't list his Marine service on the application. He just said that he was a student traveling. On the other hand, the CIA made calls to the Soviet embassy in Helsinki after the assassination in an attempt to find out how long it took to get a visa to Russia from Helsinki. They were told that if the applicant applied in person, the normal visa process took 5 to 7 days, but that it was, quote, impossible within 2 or 3 days to get a visa. According to a declassified July 10, 1964 CIA memo, Oswald said that he planned to stay at the Hotel Turney for 5 days when he checked in. We know that Oswald did, in fact, end up staying in Helsinki for exactly 5 days. He ended up switching hotels halfway through for reasons unknown, but he was able to forecast with precision exactly how long it would take him to get a visa to the Soviet Union. Lucky guess, I suppose. Another declassified document sheds even more light on why Oswald may have chosen Helsinki as his entrance point to the Soviet Union. The document says that during a lunch conversation with Gregory Golub, the Soviet consulate in Helsinki, Golub told his American State Department counterpart, quote, Moscow had given him the authority to give Americans visas without prior approval from Moscow. Golub stated that this would make his job much easier, and as long as he was convinced the American was all right, he would give him a visa in a matter of minutes. This conversation took place on July 17, 1959, just a few months before Oswald went to Helsinki. To put this into context, in every other European capital, Soviet visa applications were required to be sent to Moscow for approval. But in Helsinki only, Gregory Golub had the authority to immediately approve visa applications with no delay. This made Helsinki a very attractive entry point for anyone who wanted to get to the Soviet Union quickly. Still, we're talking about information that was shared between diplomats at a luncheon. This was by no means public knowledge. The same declassified CIA document that we were just talking about also points to another State Department dispatch talking about how two Americans who wanted to quickly apply for Soviet visas in Helsinki were told to go directly to Gregory Golub at the Soviet embassy. Golub told those Americans that he would approve their travel visas as soon as they made advance reservations with the Soviet Travel Bureau in Tourist. This State Department dispatch concerning how easy it was for two Americans to get into the Soviet Union quickly through Helsinki was sent on October 9th, 1959, the day before Oswald arrived in Helsinki. To recap, Oswald was able to afford the fanciest hotels in Helsinki, even though he was broke. He stayed there for 5 days, which is exactly how long he said he would be there, and he had his visa for entry into Russia approved immediately at the only place in the world where he could have received immediate approval. Either Oswald was getting help from someone privy to this information about the Soviet consulate in Helsinki, or he was incredibly lucky. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. The products from Uncommon Goods are high quality, they're unique, a lot of times they're handmade, and they're made in the United States. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. And because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to Uncommon Goods when I didn't know what to get that person who seemed to already have everything. Another great thing about Uncommon Goods is that they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice every time you buy something. So far, they've donated over $3 million to nonprofits. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/JFK. That's uncommongoods.com/JFK for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. Before 1958, it was rare for Americans to defect to Russia. From the end of World War II through 1959, a period of about 14 years, there were only two defectors from the United States to the Soviet Union. Those numbers suddenly ticked up over an 18-month period in 1959 and 1960, when there were nine American defectors to Russia. In 1959, the year that Oswald would attempt to defect, there were two other Americans who had already defected before him, Nicholas Petrulli and Robert Webster. Not much is known about Petrulli, but Robert Webster is potentially a very interesting character. Webster was a plastics expert who worked for Rand Development at the time of his defection. The company was founded by Henry Rand, who worked with the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, the CIA's predecessor, during World War II. George Buchbinder, who was a top executive at Rand Development, also worked for the OSS, and he reported directly to Frank Wisner, who was one of the founders of the CIA. On top of that, Christopher Byrd, who was working for the CIA at the time, served as the Washington, D.C. representative of Rand Development in the 1950s. In other words, there are clear connections between Rand Development and the CIA at the time when Robert Webster defected to Russia. Now, that doesn't prove that the CIA used Rand Development, but it means they could have. Webster went to Russia in 1959 on behalf of Rand to promote products at a trade show in Moscow. It was during this trip to Russia that Webster defected. When he went to the Soviet Office of Visas and Registrations to defect, Webster was accompanied by Henry Rand and George Buchbinder, as well as the U.S. Embassy Consul Richard Snyder. That begs the question, why would the top two executives of an American company with intelligence connections and the head of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow personally help an American to defect to Russia? It looks like either Webster's two bosses and the American consul wanted to make sure that Webster was able to live out his dreams of Soviet defection, or they wanted to make sure that he defected for other reasons. What is especially strange about Robert Webster is what he told author Dick Russell about meeting a 17-year-old Russian girl at a trade show in Moscow. Her name was Marina Prusakova, the same woman who would go on to marry Lee Harvey Oswald and move to the United States. Marina would have no reason to be at this trade show. She was from Leningrad, which was not near Moscow. Webster said that Marina spoke to him in English, but with a heavy accent. According to the Warren Report, Marina couldn't speak any English at all when she arrived in the United States. Incidentally, the Soviet government placed Webster in Marina's hometown of Leningrad when he defected. Webster lived in the Soviet Union for 2 years, married a Russian woman, and had a child with her, and then he ended up coming back to America in 1962, leaving his wife and child behind in Russia. If what Webster said about meeting Marina Oswald is true, it makes it look as though Marina could have been a KGB asset of some sort, given that she could speak English and she was going out of her way to talk to an American who was defecting. We'll come back to Robert Webster again later this season. Lee Harvey Oswald arrived in Moscow on October 16, 1959. He was taken to his hotel that night by his tour guide, Rema Shirakova, who was a KGB informant like everyone else who worked for Intourist, the state-sponsored bureau that had a monopoly on foreign travelers inside of Russia. His travel visa allowed him to stay in Russia for 6 days. On the second day of his tour, Oswald told Shirakova that he wanted to defect to the Soviet Union. On the third day of his tour, October 18th, 1959, Oswald's 20th birthday, Shirakova told her KGB contact that Oswald wanted to defect. The contact then requested that Shirakova help Oswald. So she assisted Oswald in writing a letter to the Supreme Soviet formally requesting Soviet citizenship. Shirakova also gave Oswald a Russian literature classic as a gift, a copy of Dostoevsky's The Idiot. While he was in Russia, Oswald kept a diary, which is the source of much of what we know about his time there. This diary was authenticated as being in Oswald's handwriting by the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. As you will see, some critics of the official story dispute the diary's accuracy and authenticity. Oswald's diary entry for October 21st is of particular importance. That's the day when Oswald was called to the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was told that his request for Russian citizenship had been denied and that he must leave Moscow in the next 2 hours. His diary says, quote, "I am stunned. Evening, 6 p.m. Receive word from police official. I must leave country tonight at 8 p.m. as visa expires. I am shocked. My dreams. I retire to my room. I have $100 left. I waited for 2 years to be accepted. My fondest dreams are shattered because of a petty official, because of bad planning. I planned too much. 7 p.m. I decide to end it. Soak wrist in cold water to numb the pain. Then slash my left wrist. I think when Rema comes at 8 to find me dead, it will be a great shock. Somewhere a violin plays as I watch my life whirl away. I think to myself, how easy to die and a sweet death to violins." So, according to Oswald's diary, he found out that his visa was denied around 6 p.m., he decided to take his own life at 7 p.m., and he planned to be dead by 8. Luckily for us, we have more information about this saga in the form of interviews that author Norman Mailer did with Rema Shirakova. Shirakova told Mailer that when she met Oswald, he had just arrived by train in the deluxe class, which was the most expensive class, usually reserved for only very wealthy people. Oswald's entire tour in Russia with Intourist was booked as deluxe class. She said that Oswald spoke only English and did not seem to know a word of Russian. But Shirakova's statement about the timeline of Oswald's attempted suicide seems pretty far off from Oswald's diary. She says that she arrived at his hotel at 2 o'clock and then waited for about 30 minutes before she got help to try to open Oswald's door. When the door was finally forced open by hotel security, the security guards who entered the room found Oswald in the bathroom. Shirakova didn't see if Oswald was on the floor or in the tub, but she did see him come out of the bathroom on a stretcher, unconscious, but wearing dry clothes. According to the Russian doctor who worked on him, Oswald was taken to the Botkinskaya Hospital at 4 o'clock. The cut on Oswald's left wrist was 3 to 5 centimeters long and took 4 stitches to repair. Dr. Lydia Mikhailina, a psychiatrist at Botkinskaya Hospital, described Oswald's injury as, quote, "a show suicide since he was refused political asylum, which he had been demanding. It looks like Oswald's attempt at suicide shows that he was really just desperate to stay in the Soviet Union, not that he actually intended to take his own life." On the other hand, Gerald Posner presents a very different picture. He relies on statements from the former KGB agent we mentioned earlier, Yuri Nosenko, who began providing secrets to the CIA in Geneva, Switzerland in 1961. Nosenko claimed that he was the KGB agent responsible for overseeing Oswald in Russia. The CIA had mixed feelings on whether Nosenko could be trusted and worried that he was a Russian disinformation agent. Nosenko told the CIA that Oswald was not a KGB agent, but the CIA still put Nosenko in solitary confinement for 1,277 days until he was eventually released and given a false identity and a new job with the CIA. When it comes to the suicide attempt, Nosenko says that Oswald's injury was serious enough to require blood transfusions. He also says that the KGB decided not to pursue Oswald as an agent because they thought he was mentally unstable. The reason they didn't immediately send him home is because they wanted to avoid the optics of an American student being manhandled by Soviet security forces. So instead, they decided to keep an eye on him to make sure that he didn't cause any trouble and he wasn't an American sleeper agent. So once again, we have conflicting evidence. To me, it looks like the suicide attempt was a cry for help to allow Oswald to stay in Moscow. If you believe Nosenko and ignore Shirakova, the Botkinskaya doctor, and Dr. Mikhailina, you could disagree and say that it was a bona fide suicide attempt. The reason it matters is that it speaks to whether Oswald was mentally stable. If he really attempted suicide, you could say he wasn't. But if it was a fake attempt, then it means that he desperately wanted to stay in Russia. The question is, why exactly would Oswald want to stay in Russia that bad? Next time on Solving JFK, we continue examining Oswald's time in Russia, including his U.S. embassy visit in Moscow and his experience working at a factory in Minsk. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.